Parables of the Kingdom, Matthew 13, Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. The seven parables in Matthew 13 are examined, beginning with the three parables interpreted by Jesus, followed by the four that are not interpreted. It is suggested that the parables form a chronological grid, showing the typical progress of the gospel in the society into which it has been introduced. We first of all start by listing these parables. The parable of the sower, the parable of the wheat and the weeds, traditionally the wheat and the tares, parable of the mustard seed, parable of the leaven, parable of the hidden treasure, parable of the pearl of great price, and the parable of the dragnet. If we look at these and ask which ones are interpreted by Jesus, the sower and the wheat and the weeds are, the mustard seed, the leaven, the treasure, and the pearl are not, and the dragnet is. So the first, second, and seventh are interpreted, and the middle four are not. We're only looking at these seven parables. There's an eighth parable at the end of the chapter, the parable of the householder bringing forth treasures, etc., which I don't think is quite so closely connected as these others are. We're going to look, first of all, at the interpreted parables, the parable of the sower, wheat, and the weeds, and the dragnet, and then we will look at the uninterpreted parables. We look at each of these in turn, looking first at the story and then looking at its interpretation given by Jesus. The parable of the sower gives us a picture of a fellow out planting seed by what was known as the broadcast method. The term broadcast has shifted with the arrival of the electronic age, but the broadcast method was a fellow carried a basket or a bag of seed and walked through the fields and would dip his hand into the bag and get a handful and scatter it. We're given the four cases of what happens to the seed based on the different sorts of soil it landed on. The first soil that the seed lands on is the roadside, the pathway, if you like, and there it doesn't sink in. It's the area, the roadside is heavily packed down, and birds come along and gobble the seed up. The second case, the seed falls on stony ground, by which appears to be meant a thin layer of soil over bedrock. And there the seed does germinate, and in fact that soil is often a little warmer than the kind with deeper soil, and so perhaps germinates rather quickly, and yet it is not able to put down much of any root because it doesn't have any depth of soil. And the result is that when the sun comes up and dries out the soil, it dries out the plants and they die as well. The third case is a case in which the soil itself is okay, but there are thorn plants in that soil, and in the competition with the thorns, the wheat loses out and is choked by the thorns. The last case is the case of good soil, the seed sinks into the soil, it's got deep enough area to get good roots, and it's not competing with other plants like the thorns, and yet even here we see various yields, so some of the seeds yield 30 times as much seed, some 60 times as much, and some 100 times as much. So that's the picture that Jesus gives us in this parable, given to his disciples. Jesus gives us an interpretation of the parable a little further on in the chapter, and he tells us that the seed represents the word of the kingdom, so the message, what we would perhaps today call the gospel message. The soils represent different receptions for the word. The roadside represents the reception by people who don't understand the message. And Jesus goes on to say that the birds represent Satan removing the word so that they doesn't sit around long enough for them to think it through and perhaps come to understand it later. The soil over bedrock represents the reception of the word by people in whom it does not take a deep root, does root in some way. And the result is that when trouble comes, they bail out. The thorns represent a competition, and Jesus tells us this competition for the word is the worries of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. The good soil represents reception by people who understand, accept, and hold on to the message that they have been given. And yet, even here, we see different results, although all of them are pretty substantial. Some lessons from the sower. Jesus' disciples, hearing his message and realizing that he is the Messiah, certainly, and realizing that his message is great news, that the kingdom has come and such, perhaps expected everybody to jump on the bandwagon. But the lesson we see from the sower is not everybody will accept or retain the gospel. Not everybody will jump on the bandwagon, and even of those who do, some will jump off. Some of these won't understand or respond or even remember that they heard the message. Others will fall away in persecution. Still others will be distracted by the world. But others will actually be saved. They will show their salvation in their lives. But even here, there will be real differences in the changes that are made, in the results that occur. Well, that's a quick tour of the sower. Our purpose here is not to go into great detail on each parable, but to discuss how they fit together. We move on to the parable of the wheat and the weeds. The story here, a little more unusual story. The other one was kind of an everyday picture of how wheat was planted in the Middle East at that time. Here we have something similar. The owner plants good seed, wheat, in his field. But while his laborers are sleeping, an enemy comes and wants to get revenge, perhaps, and his technique is to plant bad seed over the good seed in the same soil. So his bad seed is a weed of some sort. The weeds eventually become obvious. One guesses they don't become immediately obvious because perhaps the weed is a grass as well as the wheat is being a grass, and so they both look rather alike until perhaps the seed is put on them, then they have perhaps somewhat different looking seeds. The owners of slaves want to uproot the weeds, but the owner forbids them to do this, lest they somehow pull up the good stuff with the bad, perhaps the idea of intertwining roots or something of that sort, or just inability to be sure which is which. In any case, the owner forbids them and says, we're going to let both of them grow together till the harvest, and then he tells them what's going to happen at the harvest. At the harvest, there'll be a separation of the wheat from the weeds, and the harvesters will put the wheat in his barn, and the weeds will be burnt up. Jesus gives an interpretation of this parable as well. He tells us that the owner of the field represents himself, Jesus, the Messiah, and that the field is the world. So picture here of that. The seed in this particular parable is not, as in the parable of sower, the word, but here people. And the good seed represents the followers of Jesus, and the bad seed represents the followers of Satan. The enemy who sows this bad seed is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are the angels, and the wicked will be cast into the furnace where they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth, and the righteous will shine forth in the kingdom. That's Jesus' interpretation of the parable of the wheat and the weeds. We ask ourselves about some lessons from the parable of the wheat and the weeds. I suggest this, that the gospel will go out, as we see in the parable of the sower. But here in this parable, we see that Satan will follow the gospel with gospels and Christians of his own. And the owner's refusal to have the weeds pulled up suggests that it won't be possible to destroy these Christians, fake Christians, and their false gospels without drastic disruptions in society of the sort that will take place at the end of the age, but apparently not before. But they will finally be destroyed at the judgment. Though believers often seem to get lost in all this confusion, certainly a common objection of unbelievers is, look at all the religions there are out there. Why should we believe yours, etc.? Although believers often seem to get lost in this confusion, they will shine in God's kingdom. We move on now to the seventh parable, since we're doing the three interpreted parables first, and that's the parable of the dragnet. We show you a picture there of how a dragnet is used in a, here looking at a fairly shallow lake, perhaps. A dragnet is a long rectangular net with its width equal to the depth of water you'll be using it in. And floats are put along one side of the net so that that side of the net will stay on the surface of the water. And weights are put on the other side of the net so that the that side will drag on the bottom. And then this the long part of it, hundreds of feet long often, will be put out in the water and set out in such a way to enclose a region of water fairly near the shore usually. And then the fishermen will drag the net up on shore now with all the fish that have been trapped in it. Once they have it ashore with the fish are then sorted into those which they can sell at the marketplace and those which are economically worthless, and the latter are thrown away, perhaps used as fertilizer in a field or something of that sort. Jesus gives an interpretation of the dragnet. He tells us that the fishermen represent the angels, the fish represent the righteous and the wicked. The drawing of the net represents the end of the age. So we're getting a fish harvest here that is parallel to the the wheat and weed harvest, if you like, in the parable of the wheat and the weeds. The sorting of the fish represents the separation of the righteous and the wicked. The putting of the goods into the good fish into containers is parallel to gathering the wheat into the barn in the other parable. And the throwing away the bad is parallel to putting the weeds into the fire and the wheat being gnashed in the teeth. Lessons from the dragnet. Well, one of the big lessons, based on the nature of a dragnet, there will be no escape from judgment at the end of the age. There will be a complete and accurate separation of righteous and wicked. The fate of the wicked is terrible, burning, weeping, being thrown away. Well, that's the three parables that Jesus gives an interpretation for. We now come to the uninterpreted parables, the parable of the mustard and the leaven, the parable of the treasure, and the parable of the pearl. So, four parables, mustard, leaven, treasure, pearl. We see divergent views on what to make of these parables. The other three parables interpreted by Jesus, so those who believe Jesus, those who are Bible believers, those who believe the Bible gives us a good record, accept Jesus' interpretation. We won't follow off after the liberals who do not. But for these where there's no interpretation given, we get divergent interpretation even among Bible believers. It's very clear that these parables form two pairs, that the mustard seed and the leaven are a pair. And it's pretty clearly about growth of some sort, and the hidden treasure and the pearl are about finding of some sort. Now, the divergence is this. The parable of mustard seed and the parable of leaven, some see the growth of both of these as good growth. Others see the growth of both of these as bad growth. We're going to suggest, and we'll give some argument for it in a moment, that one of the growths is a good growth and one of the growths represents a bad growth. The parable of treasure and the pearl, the divergence takes this form. Some see the treasure and the pearl as either Christ or the gospel, and the seeker, the finder in the field or the pearl merchant, is the believer, and he gives up everything to have Christ or the gospel. Others see the treasure and the pearl as Israel or the church, and that the seeker is Christ, and that Christ gives up everything to have Israel or the church. So we're going to have to come back and think about that. Method we're going to follow is this. We're going to try and use the interpreted parables to help us understand the uninterpreted ones, thinking about their context, about the use of symbolism in these parables, and suggest that there's a chronological structure here. We're going to also use Old Testament and New Testament background. Does the Old Testament have similar figures to the figures that we see in these parables? Does the New Testament have similar figures, or does it actually give what might be an interpretation of these parables somewhere? That's the approach we're going to use. Is there a structure of the whole series? Well, let's lay the series out here in front of us and take a look at it. Here we have the seven parables on the left, and the parable of the sower and the parable of weeds have got planting in them, although the weeds has also got planting, growth, and harvest. Huh? Parable of mustard seed and the parable of leaven have got growth in them. The parable of treasure and the pearl seem to be running along another direction. They're both about finding. And the parable of the dragnet is about harvest. And we certainly see a chronological order of some sort. Planting, growth, harvest. May suggest that the whole structure is chronological in some way. We're going to come back and try and do something with that by and by. Let's look then at the parable of the mustard and the parable of leaven and think about the stories. Both planting mustard seed and seeing it grow up and putting leaven in dough, etc., are rather common in New Testament times. Mustard seed is a very small seed, the smallest seed that was used in agriculture. And when it's planted, it becomes a large herb, or in some cases, as here, a small tree. When the tree gets big enough, it attracts birds, and that's the case that the Jesus here, the author of the parable, provides for us. Leaven is involved with making bread by the sourdough method, rather than buying a package of yeast from your grocery store. In antiquity, basically, yeast, since it floats around in the air, would naturally get into dough now and then and make that dough leavened and what we would call sour. And when a woman is making up a batch of dough, or a baker making up a batch of dough, they will put into that batch of dough some dough from an earlier batch that is leavened, what they call some sourdough, and that spreads and makes the whole dough leavened and puffs it up, and it has a slight sourish taste, if you like. That's the way bread is made by the sourdough method. The amount of dough in this particular case is rather large, but in fact we have Old Testament precedents for this large amount. It's presumably the sort of amount that would be made when a woman in the household is making up perhaps a batch for a week or something of that sort. How are you to interpret the parable of the mustard and the seed in the parable of leaven? Well, it's controversial. In general, covenantal theologians have tended to interpret the growth of the mustard seed and the spread of the leaven as both good, and dispensationalists have tended to interpret the growth of the mustard seed and the mustard plant and the spread of the leaven as bad. In context, however, the parable of the sower and the parable of the weeds taken together give us the planting of both the good and the bad, and the parable of the weeds gives us the growing of both the good and the bad, and the parable of the weeds and the parable of dragnet give us the harvesting of both the good and the bad. So it's not unreasonable to suggest that maybe we're looking at the growth of both the good and the bad in the mustard and the leaven, and we could see both good and bad in each, I suppose, but no distinction is made of any sort, so it'd make better sense to see one is good and one is bad. And from figurative use elsewhere, it would not be hard to tell which is which. From figurative use elsewhere, we have when a tree grows up and attracts birds, that this is some sort of picture of a of a kingdom or empire, if you like, and the birds represent those that are dependent upon or benefit from this large tree. You see that in Ezekiel 31 and in Daniel 4. Leaven, of course, is pictured in Old Testament liturgy as something which is not to be in most of the grain sacrifices, certainly not any of the grain sacrifices in which it's a payment for sin in any way. So it has, if you like, a somewhat negative feel to it there. You think about the practice of removing leaven from everything in connection with the events following Passover. Jesus also uses leaven. He says, a little leaven leavens the whole. He says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, etc. Obviously not a favorable use there. And Paul says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump, again, in a picture of bad living or a false doctrine, something of that sort. So figurative use elsewhere is rather negative for leaven. So suggestion perhaps that the leaven here is a picture of something problematical. We suggest that the growth of the mustard plant pictures the growth of the gospel or church in a society. And when the gospel becomes big enough, the church becomes big enough in that society, the birds move in. You remember that birds already in our set of parables were pictured rather negatively in the first parable, parable of sower, representing Satan snatching away the word. So perhaps something negative here. And in the Old Testament as well, birds that show up in connection with the dream that the baker has in Genesis that Joseph interprets is a rather negative figure as well. So we suggest the birds here represent something that's not good moving in to the church when it becomes big enough. We suggest that the growth of the leaven then pictures not the spread of Christianity internally, inside people, inside a society, but the spread of unbelief within the church. Now, going on this kind of a mode, we suggest this as lessons for the parable of the mustard and the parable of leaven. Despite a small start, the church will often grow to dominate the society it is in. Once it begins to dominate, people will begin to join for wrong reasons. False teaching will then be able to work far more effectively within than it could before, often coming to thoroughly permeate the church. So, that's our suggestion there. What about the treasure and the pearl? Well, the stories, two specific incidents of finding and buying. The treasure is found accidentally by somebody in a field. It's not his own field. We see that from the context. So presumably it's found accidentally by a tenant or farm laborer. That'd be the most likely case. In the Middle East, even today, there are many people with dreams of finding a treasure in some kind of a clay pot hidden in the field or cave or something of that sort. And that's the sort of thing that was going on with the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls back a half century ago. Person having found it doesn't carry it into town or go off to start spending it. Questions will arise too quickly that way. Instead, he hides it again and then goes and sells everything he owns in order to get clear title to the land. And once he's purchased the land, then he can go find the treasure, and it now belongs to him. So that's basically what we have in the story of the hidden treasure. Parable of Pearl, this isn't found accidentally. This is found intentionally by a pearl merchant. Not to say that he knows where this particular pearl is or anything of that sort, but he's looking, but he knows what he's looking for, okay? Now, whereas the other guy was apparently not looking. He just found it accidentally. So this pearl is found intentionally by a pearl merchant, somebody that really knows what a good pearl is and what a crummy pearl is. This pearl is so good that the pearl merchant sells everything to have this pearl as his own. Well, how do we interpret these? Well, we said already it was controversial. For some, the treasure and the pearl is Christ or the gospel, and the believer is the finder who gives all to have it. And for others, the treasure or the pearl is the church or Israel, and Christ gives everything to have it. Well, if we look at our context, if the parables form a chronology, I think it's more likely that the first alternative is right rather than the second, namely that we're looking at some kind of a progress of the gospel through a society, and the good gospels and the bad gospels are growing together, and the suggestion is that when the leaven, so to speak, has leavened the whole lump, it's going to become very hard to find the gospel. And so here are two people. One stumbles over the gospel, and the other finds the gospel because he's looking for something of that sort. And I think that reads better. So it fits the scheme of salvation history, if you like. Figurative use elsewhere. Well, we certainly can't buy salvation. And so that's a problem for the idea that the treasure of the pearl is Christ or the gospel, if you like. But on the other hand, we are called upon to give up everything for Christ and the gospel. And the gospel is indeed a treasure. We have this treasure in hidden vessel, in the earthen vessel, says Paul in 2 Corinthians 4:7. So that would be my suggestion, is to go that particular way. If we do that, we get this lesson. When false teaching has done all its work, the gospel may be hard to find. Still, some will find it. Some will find it by accident, some will find it by looking. I think of C.S. Lewis, who in his Surprised by Joy and his more parabolic story, Pilgrim's Progress, tells that he was looking for something, and he knew what it was, but he didn't realize the ins and outs of it. And I think there are people like that, that are in the world looking, and when they suddenly understand the gospel, they see that's really what they're looking for, that they didn't realize it. Well, still, some will find it. Both will recognize its surpassing value. Both will give up everything to have it. And both will realize that they've gotten a great bargain, that it was not a huge sacrifice to give up everything to have it. All that, I think, fits well with this being Christ or the gospel. We try to put together a summary on the kingdom parables. The sower gives us various responses to the gospel. The weeds tell us about the false gospels of Satan. The mustard seed about the growth of the church. The leaven about the growth of error in the church. The treasure, the gospel being found by accident. The pearl, the gospel being found by search. And the dragnet, God will judge and God will separate. And we see a chronological sequence. I don't think it's a chronological sequence so much of the whole of church history, from the beginning of the church history to the end of the age, but rather kind of a sequence in a particular culture into which the gospel comes. So it's if you like, a typical progress of the gospel in a particular society or ethnic group or something of that sort. Probably the cycle starts over in some sense when God sends a revival. In societies with no state church, you may find that various groups will be in various stages of the cycle, whereas if you've got kind of just restricted to one state church, it may run much more uniformly over that particular cycle we've looked at. Well, that's the end of this rather quick discussion of the parables of the kingdom. We recognize that the end is coming, that it's important for us to make the right decisions, to be discerning. And a good prayer for each of us is, may God help us to be discerning, that we may recognize the difference between truth and error, that we may be willing to give up everything to find Jesus, to have Jesus, to hold Jesus. May it be so in our lives.